Super excited to be with you. My name is Dustin Yankowski. I'm one of the campus life pastors here. I don't think, as a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I know that none of us likes to be proven wrong, being shown that we misunderstand something. I'm wrong a lot, been married almost 20 years, get reminded of how wrong I am a lot, because it's true. It doesn't get easier, though, the more it happens, right? Sometimes it's not that big of a deal, though, when you're wrong about something. The cost is small. You put something together from IKEA, don't read the instructions, you find out, oops, made a mistake, take it apart, worst case, right? Start over. But consequences can range, right, from little significance to a lot of significance based on what we misunderstand. I studied abroad a year in Japan in high school, had zero knowledge of language or culture, just decided it was a great idea. So plenty of opportunity to misunderstand, right, in a different nation, in a different culture. One day, I was out with my host family, and they came across a family that they knew, had a new baby, and me, wanting to be the nice foreigner, went up to the baby and the mom in Japanese and said, "Your baby is incredibly, incredibly cute." She immediately recoiled, gave me a strange face, turned her back on me. I was like, oh, rude, like what? This is, I don't understand. But later I found out I had said kawaii instead of kawaii. Now, you can see here how similar that is, right? Kawaii, kawaii, two entirely different words. Kawaii means cute. And I said kawaii, which meant I told this new mom that her baby was incredibly, incredibly terrifying. Her reaction made a lot more sense. I learned something. Thankfully, the consequences of that misunderstanding, maybe I just reinforced the stereotype, like Americans are rude or something, right? But what if the consequences get more severe? What if the consequences of misunderstanding aren't just temporary? What if they're eternal? If you would imagine a timeline from this stage that went through the middle aisle, out the doors, and just kept going, right, for all of eternity, like an eternal timeline, all of human history would just be like in a few feet, right? You have Adam and Eve, Jesus, the fall of Rome, medieval times, Chick-fil-A starts, like your life starts today, and in a million years, we'd only be about right here. And the Bible is super clear that the choices you and I make here in just our little few little decades have consequences for eternity. So if the stakes are eternal, we can't afford to get this wrong. Be left guessing. And yet, if you and I, if we all just walked across Westerville and started to poll people, right? Just the average person. Hey, how do you think you leverage your time here to ensure that we're with God here? What kind of answers would we get? Would we get a consensus? Would there be, everybody be just super clear? We'd probably get answers ranging from, hey, you just try to be a good person. Maybe we'd get other religions and their answer. Maybe you get, hey, you just do you, and at the end it works out. Maybe we would get Jesus. But the most common answer according to Lifeway research is that 2/3 of people asked, how do you get to heaven, respond with some answer in the form of, I don't know. If there's eternity and there is a God, and we can be made right with him, this is something you and I cannot afford to have misunderstanding on, or just be left guessing. And the great news is God doesn't leave us guessing. God does not leave us guessing. That's why we're spending this season in the book of Galatians. Because Galatians is fundamentally a book about the gospel, how you and I can be made right with God. And Paul, he's writing to the church in Galatia, not because they don't have the gospel. It's because they started to misunderstand the gospel already. And we're just a few years into the church, and there's already misunderstanding. There's already a debate about what the gospel is. And so Paul writes for them, he writes for us, essentially saying this is what the gospel is. And maybe more importantly, this is what the gospel isn't. And so the first thing that Paul writes that we see is that, one, the gospel is Jesus plus nothing else. The gospel is Jesus plus nothing else. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 6. Then after 14 years, this is Paul. Then after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas. I took Titus along also. I went in response to a revelation and, meeting privately with those esteemed as leaders, I presented to them the gospel that I preach among the Gentiles. I wanted to be sure I was not running and had not been running my race in vain. Yet not even Titus, who was with me, was compelled to be circumcised, even though he was a Greek. This matter arose because some false believers had infiltrated our ranks to spy on the freedom we have in Christ Jesus and to make us slaves. We did not give in to them for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you. And as for those who were held in high esteem, whatever they were makes no difference to me. God does not show favoritism. They added nothing to my message. So Paul goes up to Jerusalem with Barnabas and Titus. And there's a pretty cool dynamic in their traveling party. I don't know if you've ever had somebody in your life that has mentored or discipled you or poured into you, but Barnabas mentored Paul early on in his faith. And Titus was actually led to Jesus and mentored by Paul. So, I mean, they're all super close and they're going together up to Jerusalem where the apostles are. And they're going to figure out if the gospel that Paul has been preaching for the past 14 years to the Gentiles is the same one that they're preaching to the Jewish people. And you see in verse 4, he's confirming this. This needs to be confirmed because a matter arose. There's been a debate. They say, I say, around the gospel that's created some misunderstanding that he's going to clear up. And one side of the argument is the Judaizers. And the word Judaizer comes from this Greek verb meaning to live according to Jewish customs. So they're on one side of the argument. And in Acts 15, we see their side of the argument super clear. And Acts 15, there's really not a consensus if Acts 15 is a retelling of what's going on in Galatians 2 or if it's a different issue and a different debate entirely. But actually, the issue is the exact same at the core, right? Acts 15, verse 1, here's what they say. Here's their stance. Certain people came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the believers, unless you're circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you can't be saved. So the Judaizers were fine with Jesus, but believed that on his own, Jesus was not enough to be saved. A person needed to be circumcised, needed to be Jewish first, essentially, and then you could add Jesus. And Paul, he was on the other side of the debate, obviously. Verse 5, I love this. Man, we did not even give in to them for a moment so the truth of the gospel would be preserved for you, for us. And Paul doesn't budge. Paul doesn't mess around with matters of eternity. The consequences are too high. You know, I love he didn't say, well, you know, that's your truth. There could be two gospels, I guess, and, you know, people can choose. No, Paul says, I got the truth of the gospel from Jesus. And he didn't give a plus one to himself. The gospel is Jesus plus nothing else. And this is why I love that Paul brought Titus. You know, sometimes in a debate, you can kind of get theoretical. People would become like armchair theologians. Well, you know, theoretically, the gospel is achieved through. He's like, no, theoretically. This is Titus. He's a Greek. He has faith. Are you going to make him get circumcised? Does he need something else on top of Jesus to be good? Verse 3, not even Titus, who was with me, was compelled to be circumcised, even though he was a Greek. It's like, boom. Case closed. Not even Titus was compelled to be circumcised. Such a crucial verse. I mean, we don't see that on coffee mugs. We don't see that people getting tattoos with that. But it is absolutely, I mean, it's Paul's closing argument to the gospel. Jesus doesn't need a plus one. Because the moment you and I add something to Jesus to make us more acceptable to God, we make Jesus insufficient. It is absolutely critical. Paul forces this issue of grace into the open. It's the center of the entire debate. The gospel is we are saved by grace through faith, not a result of works. Favor of God, undeserved, unmerited favor of God towards us in Jesus, if we have faith. Grace means we contribute nothing. Even if it's 0.01%, it's not grace anymore, and it's not the gospel. Paul in Romans writes this, 11:6, and if by grace, then it cannot be based on works. If it were, grace would no longer be grace. Adding anything to Jesus to make us more acceptable to God makes Jesus insufficient. And I love Ephesians 2, and I know this might be overkill, but this is literally my favorite chapter in the whole Bible, and I have a microphone, so you have to listen. But Paul lays this, the gospel out so beautifully. And in this small section, 9 verses, he lays out our work and he lays out Jesus's work. And it's beautiful. I'm not even gonna put it on the screen. I just want you to listen, okay? Verses 1 through 3. And you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind. So Paul is saying, actually, you do have a part in salvation in the equation. It's what gets you into the mess that you're in. That's 100% on you. And look at all the action verbs he uses that we do. We walked, we followed, we lived, we carried our way into being separated with God, under judgment and wrath for our sin and rebellion against him. But, verse 4, but God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved, and raised us up with him, and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, so that in the coming ages he might show the immeasurable riches of his grace in kindness towards us in Jesus. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one can boast. And our work 100% separates us from God. And Jesus' work 100% reconciles us to God. All you need apart from Jesus is nothing. And very few of us come with nothing. Right? Don't we wrestle with feeling the need to bring something to grace? Why is that? Why are we tempted to add something to grace? Why do we get insecure in believing it's just on Jesus? It's only Jesus. I think a lot of it's the operating system we learn growing up, right? We understand work, reward, earn it, effort. You get it, you achieve. That's why the numbers say more than half the people polled think the equation of how to get to heaven is at least some part based on our effort. Now, I feel like I got to clarify, like, I don't want us to hear, hey, grace and effort is the enemy. Effort isn't the enemy, because Paul was a beast of an apostle. Like, he planted, he served, he suffered, he traveled, he taught, he did a lot for the kingdom. The problem isn't effort. The problem is when our effort tries to earn what Jesus has secured. And that's an important distinction that we don't naturally all the time make, because we're so familiar with earning and effort. There's a difference between working hard because you love the Lord and working hard because you're terrified that he'll stop loving you if you don't. That's an important distinction we gotta make. Grace does not eliminate effort, it eliminates earning. So let me push a little bit here, because I think this gets personal if we actually dig into our own heart. When you think about God, just take a second, think about you and God, standing before God. What percent of your confidence and where you stand with him comes from something you've done, something you're doing, or something you hope to do? What percent of your confidence comes from you? Because it's easy to pile on the Judaizer, stupid Judaizers, plus circumcision, that's crazy. But I don't think it's a Judaizer thing. I think it's a human heart thing, right? Grace can be a stumbling block for all of us. So how do we add to Jesus to make ourselves right with God? How does that function and look? What do we plus one? What do we add? And I think there's a tons of ways, but I just had three quick possibilities. Jesus plus being good enough, right? We just gotta be good enough. I don't know what that means, but we all kind of feel that sometimes. There's a line of good enough, and you know, we just hope to be on the other side of the bell curve once term ends. And, you know, it's not circumcision, but we're doing comparison all the time because we're like, well, I don't know how good enough is, but apparently I'm good enough, I'm better than them. Like, maybe I'm not as good as them. And so we're constantly looking and trying to compare ourselves to see where we stand, adding something to Jesus. Grace looks at Jesus to know where we stand, right? But Jesus plus being good enough looks, we got to know. Are we good enough? This might describe you if someone were to ask you, how do you know if you're going to heaven? You might think or say, man, I'm trying. You heard that? You said that? I'm trying. Our acceptance is tied to effort and earning. The good news Paul has for us is, man, we can stop keeping score with God. We can stop keeping score. His love isn't measured by our performance. This next one is close to that, but a little bit nuanced. It's Jesus plus making up for the big stuff that's in your past, right? Making up for the big stuff in your past. The cross, you might think, all right, Jesus covers that. That's okay. Those are, everybody does that. But this, whew, I got a lot of shame and guilt there. Like that's a big one. Like, and I knew better. And I did it habitually. Like, I'm sure God shakes his head at that just like I shake my head at that. And so functionally what happens is you try to atone for that. It's Jesus' atonement is good for the 98%, but that 2%, I've got to work at that. I've got to atone for that somehow. So behind your good works in that sense, there's a motivation to earn and add on to Jesus, to clean yourself up. Does your guilt and shame have you still trying to pay a debt that Jesus has already paid in full? This last one is more personal. This is my example, but hopefully it lands. Is that you need affirmation from others. This might be you. If I were to ask you, where do you stand with God? You go, I have no clue. And I have actually no understanding of what to base it on. So I'm actually going to look for the affirmation of others to tell me, you're good. And then, oh, I'm good. Right? And so I'll come to church. I'll do people stuff that Jesus people would do. Do you read your Bible? Do you serve? What do you do? What do you do? Okay, you do that. Am I good? I'm good. But your hope is ultimately in yourself and not in Jesus. If you add something to Jesus to make you more acceptable to God, you've made Jesus insufficient. You have no gospel at all. And so up until this point, we've talked about what the gospel is and isn't, right? It's an important distinction to make. And maybe you thought, man, hey, I knew what the gospel was. Oh, it's that? And maybe God's doing something inside of you. Maybe you were misunderstanding it. Maybe you had a plus one. Will you trust and put your faith in Jesus plus nothing else? And this next section is for those of us who do know, who do believe, who do trust. Hey, it's Jesus plus nothing else. But sometimes my life looks like I don't believe that, which is literally all of us. Like, we're all hypocrites sometimes, right? But this next part is for us, okay? Third point, we can believe the gospel and live like it isn't true. You and I can functionally believe the gospel but live like it's not true. Chapter 2, verses 11 through 14, Paul writes, "But when Cephas," that's Peter, "came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, 'If you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews?'" So Peter is fine eating with the Gentiles until the Jewish people come. And then he retreats and separates himself. Now, Jews didn't eat with the Gentiles. They thought it would make them unclean in the eyes of God. But Peter knew the gospel. Peter knew that God accepted the Gentiles through Jesus. And yet his behavior started communicating a different gospel altogether. We are told in verse 12 that Peter feared the circumcision party. In that moment, for Peter, functionally, it became Jesus plus the approval of other people. Sometimes our behavior can reveal a theology that our mouths would never admit. This is all of us. This is all of us. I mean, if this is Peter, the rock which Jesus built his church on, who walked with Jesus, I mean, surely you and I can admit, like, sometimes we get off and out of step too, right? In verse 4, Paul talks about people who wanted to take the freedom they have in Jesus and bring them back into bondage, into slavery. Sure, he was talking about the Judaizers plus their the circumcision, right? But this happens to any plus one that you and I add to Jesus. That thing will control how we live. The choices that we make, the behavior that we have, that thing will control us. And we see this with Peter and his need for the approval of people. I mean, listen, Peter thinks he needs their approval to be okay, right? So then his life starts getting built around acquiring that approval and maintaining that approval. He makes choices to get it, choices to keep it. The thought of him not having it causes fear in him. He's not experiencing the freedom in Jesus. He's in slavery to their approval. That's the nature of spiritual slavery. You aren't free when you have it because you're afraid of losing it. And you're not okay when you don't have it because you feel like you can't be okay without it. So I just want us to slow down for a second. I mean, my hope for me, for us, is that we let this read us for a moment. Whatever we add to Jesus will show up in how we live, in the choices we make, our behaviors, our priorities, the things we chase, or the things we can't let go of. What might your life be revealing that you depend on beside Jesus? Again, just some places this can show up. I mean, Westerville, I chose these ones carefully. I hope it lands. We're in a pretty good spot. A lot of people are successful here. So that's why I think sometimes the Jesus plus one can be my success and how productive I am. We constantly fill our calendar because slowing down makes us uncomfortable. We might say, I cannot wait until life slows down. And it never does because there's someone that keeps filling our calendar and they look like us. Maybe being productive has become more about more than just something we do. And maybe it's becoming how we prove something about ourselves. And Jesus has already secured that. And we might know that, but Jesus plus success, production. We're no longer okay with just working hard. We're using work to tell ourselves, man, I'm okay. And maybe it's money. I mean, Jesus talked a lot about money. I can't skip over that. It's not just whether you have money. It's whether gaining or losing money changes your sense of security or peace. Hey, Jesus is where we find our ultimate security or peace, security and peace. But hey, if I have less than I need, I think I need, I don't have that security or peace. And then when money becomes a thing that gives us that security, man, our choices, don't they start to follow that? Start bending our lives around protecting it, gaining it, keeping it. Parenting, again, super personal example for me. I was talking with Matthew about this, and he pointed out something that's interesting. You know, the question you and I used to use in conversation when we met somebody to try to figure them out is like, kind of like, what's your resume? What do you do? You know, who are you? But more and more that's become, hey, what do your kids do? What are they into? What's their resume? As a parent, it sneaks up on us because we love our kids so much. You want what's best for them, but sometimes their success can start feeling like your success. Their failures can start feeling like your failures. Sometimes your child struggles, fails, or makes a different choice than you would, and it feels like a statement about you. Their success starts telling us, you're good. Their failure starts telling us, you failed. Our parenting can slowly become about proving something about ourselves rather than just simply loving and shepherding our kids. I mean, just like Peter, something else other than the gospel starts influencing our behavior and pulls us out of step. Possessions. Do you think everything you own just gives you a sense of like, I've arrived, right? We've got that. We're secure. I'm okay. Sometimes it's not about wanting nice things. It's about those things making a statement about who we are. Image and approval. This one directly connects with Peter. It's how people see you more important than how God sees you. Are there places where you change what you say, what you do, or even what you believe because you're afraid of what others would think? Now, listen, we spend as much time at work almost as we do at home, right? Those are the people you build connections with, relationships with. Does what you believe change? Does your behavior change there? Because, man, it's weird just to stick out. It makes me uncomfortable. So I just make concessions here, change my behavior here, fall in line here. That's Peter. He didn't wake up and decide, I'm going to reject the gospel. He was afraid of people, and that fear started making decisions for him. Where have your choices, your behavior, gotten out of step with the gospel? You know, I'm grateful for Peter's run-in with Paul here. Peter's life reminds us that the Christian life does not just begin with grace. It's not just the door and then it's on you. Man, it's the house we live in as Christians. It's everything. It's the door in and it's every day. I need God's grace because my life falls out of step with the gospel every day. And growing in my faith isn't simply learning to behave better. I don't behave my way out of that. I throw myself on his grace daily. and live like the gospel is actually true. And sometimes, I think for us, we have to learn to grow in the freedom of the gospel that we've been given and that we believe. Not just know it, but like experience it. That the gospel doesn't just set you free from the penalty of sin and death, that it actually frees you from the things you used to live for. If you see a gap today in your behavior and what you believe, don't just automatically kick into effort mode. Okay, here's what I need to do. Here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna achieve my way out of this. That's not the answer. Throw yourself on His grace. His grace is sufficient for that. And He's super patient with you as you learn to day by day walk in the truth that we're free. And He loves us, and His love endures the moments we fall short. And so maybe some of us need to just pray just in this moment, like, Jesus, like, I know You're enough. I know that. I'm just not living like You're enough here. Like, I'm looking for something in that only You give. Jesus is enough to be saved. Jesus is enough for our identity. Jesus is enough for your value and your worth. I know we've talked about this on an individual level mostly so far, but to close, you know, I kind of geek out a little bit thinking about our church, what our church could become, like if we actually embrace this. If we would just learn to day by day walk in the grace and freedom, totally confident of who we are in Jesus. I mean, just take a second and imagine with me a church, being a church that people can obey God without constantly wondering if they're doing enough. Walking in that freedom. Where men and women serve without needing people to notice to feed an image. Where people repent and bring sin into light without shame or hiding it because they know that has no power over them anymore. Where we can fail without feeling like our identity is being attacked or destroyed. Where we can rest without feeling guilty. Where we can work hard without needing our work to tell us who we are. And where we can celebrate other people's success without feeling like it diminishes us a little bit. Man, that's freedom. I mean, that's a church that is totally confident in who they are in Jesus. It's not being a church who doesn't work hard, not a church that doesn't care, not a church that doesn't actually radically love one another. It's just not doing those things in order to feel okay and needing them to tell us that we're okay because we actually believe Jesus is enough. So I'm gonna pray for us, pray that we would be that church, pray that I would be that person. You can pray with me. Jesus, first off, thank You for being enough. We sing these songs, but they are rooted in truth. You are enough. Forgive us, forgive me for the ways I try to add to You, to prove ourselves or find my worth somewhere else. Help us, God, to be a church that doesn't just believe the gospel with our mouths, but to live like it's true. Free us from the need to earn what You have already given. And when we are tempted to look anywhere else for our identity, our security, our acceptance, remind us You are enough. In Your name I pray.